Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, Michael visits West Side Story at the Paper Mill Playhouse. Peter sees three one-act plays at Signature. We talk about Penny Fuller and Anita Gillette at the Metropolitan Room, The Taming of the Shrew at the Delacorte Theater, Turn Me Loose, a play about comic genius Dick Gregory at the West Side Theater, and Calla Camo at Rattlesnakes Playwrights Theater. That plus more. Please stay tuned.
And a little bit shabby. In your rainbow,
cease to shine. You've got those
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, June 12, 2016, also known as the Tony Awards Day. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
We are recording on Sunday morning as the rehearsal for the Tony Awards are going on. So, obviously, if you are listening to us after the Tony Awards, we don't have any information here for you, but we will be recapping it on Today on Broadway later on tomorrow. So, if you want to check that out, please listen to Today on Broadway. Peter and Michael got a chance to see West Side Story at the Paper Mill Playhouse. Peter talked about it a little bit last week, and Michael, give us your views on this now.
I can only echo everything that Peter said. It's an absolutely magnificent production. I kind of wish, I mean, I had wished this already, that the last Broadway revival had not happened because I thought it was so misguided in so many ways. But now I wish even more that it had not happened, because had it not happened, I suspect that there would be a greater chance of this one coming to Broadway, which it absolutely should. Although, you know, I was thinking, it's funny, I may have mentioned this, I saw that wonderful production of West Side Story at the Knockdown Center in Queens about 6 months ago or whenever that was. And there have been others recently. And I was thinking it's interesting because this is, of course, 2016. Next year is actually the 50th anniversary of the opening of the original Broadway production. So I wonder if we will see more. And I'm also kind of hoping that maybe this one can come to Broadway anyway, at least for a limited run. There was just I glanced at something yesterday. I don't even remember where or who it was, but somebody said that somebody was doing a poll somewhere of the greatest musical of all time, and West Side Story was winning. So I'm not at all surprised. I went on last week when Peter was talking and before I saw the Paper Mill production about what an incredible, immortal work of art it is. In every respect, the Paper Mill production is just gorgeous. The original Jerome Robbins choreography has been reproduced by Alex Sanchez to perfection. Mark Hobie directed, who is the producing artistic director of Paper Mill, not always my favorite director, but did a superb job just letting everyone, allowing everyone to give a really wonderful, beautiful, natural performance. The orchestra is, I didn't actually count it, but I think it's in the high 20s, and directed, music director Steve Orrick. The every single there were two things that I did not like about the show. I thought that, oddly enough, whoever it was who sang somewhere in the ballet off stage had a completely the wrong kind of a voice, a very thin pop type of voice. And I thought, how odd when everything else in this show is so beautiful that they could not find someone else to sing that off stage. So that was very odd. And then I thought the other thing was relatively quite minor. I thought the fellow who played Baby John was maybe over-exaggerating the kid voice a little bit. But other than that, my God, Matt Doyle, who, again, I had never seen in any role remotely equivalent to Tony, had no idea. He had such a beautiful voice. I mean, I suppose he probably has shown it in places where I haven't seen it. Like I know he does the Skivvies concerts a lot. We had the Skivvies on our podcast some time ago. I know he's appeared with them on several occasions. So I guess then he has had a chance to show his voice. But I only really know him from Bye Bye Birdie, in which he didn't hardly sing a note. And Spring Awakening, which I'm not sure if he had any solo lines in that, although I'm not sure. I think maybe he took over one of the leads at one point. Anyway, I have not seen him in any role that required the kind of voice that Tony requires. And he, aside from that, he was pretty perfect for the role because he has a very, I would say, like a very almost a baby face. So Tony's youth absolutely still came out, even though he's in actuality several years older than Tony would be. He looked completely right in that terms. But he also, in recent years, has become quite built. So it even satisfied that requirement of the role, because one thing that's often missing in Tony's is that, you know, he is supposed to have been the leader. He and Riff were supposed to have been the co-leaders of the gang, and Tony was supposed to have had a reputation. There's a line, he's got a rep as big as the Upper West Side as a fighter, you know, but now he's given that all up and he's moving away from it, and he's, you know, his soul is coming forward, and he's becoming, you know, looking forward to love, really. So he had all of that down absolutely 100%. And he was, you know, certainly one of the best Tonys I've ever seen. The Maria, never heard of her before. Belinda Allen, absolute perfection. Looked very young. Gorgeous voice. When she hit that high, I think it's a high C in the quintet, it was like the roof came off the theater. It was beautiful, but also her acting was so sincere and so sweet and so wonderful. Everyone else, Anita, Natalie Cortez, this Mikey Winslow guy, who was the best, certainly in every way, but the best acted Riff I've ever seen, because you really got the impression that his coolness was so studied and so manufactured, and it was all basically a pose. You know, he's acting. I mean, he's got this wall up, and he, you know, he's the leader of this gang, and this is how he has to behave. And I never seen anyone quite get that specific realization of that part. It was incredible. The sets and costumes, the sets I thought were really, really gorgeous. Scenic design by James Humans, who costumes David Woolard, lighting Charlie Morrison. I think that some or all of them were involved with the Broadway revival, and that was the best aspect of the revival, not the direction and not the performances, the Broadway revival. But I'm really, as I said before we started recording, to Peter and James, I think I'm going to try to pay to go back to see West Side Story of Paper Mill.
The ultimate compliment.
Just it is. It's only through June 26th. But if there is any way that any of you can get there. I've been saying this a lot lately, but I've been seeing some really great things lately. So I don't want to, I hope it doesn't sound like I'm, you know, that it's devaluing it when I say this too often, but
I worry about that too.
Yeah. But I think Peter will back me up. Well, he already
will. Absolutely. Yeah. I have a question, though.
Yes.
You know, G. Officer Krupke contains the lyric "Leaping Lizards," a phrase that originated with Little Orphan Annie. Now, performing in the original cast of that number and playing a character known as Big Deal was Martin Charnock. Within 20 years, he'd conceive and direct a show and would write the lyrics for a musical that was a song and dance take on that Little Orphan Girl who made Leaping Lizards famous. Charnin, did Krupke subconsciously put the idea into your head to write a show called Annie? I just wonder. So, anyway, I'm done.
And Peter singled out, I have to William Ragsdale as Shrank. Yeah. It was like a Tony Oscar-worthy performance.
Oh, I'm so glad you feel that way.
You know, a role that is so often just almost a device or a throwaway. He was just great. You will never see a better Shrank than.
I thoroughly agree. I mean, this is one of those famous things about there are no small parts. Nobody told this guy that this was a small part. And while Simon Oakland in the movie is annoyed, this guy is ferocious. And that's much more believable under the circumstances.
Yes, and especially because from his first appearance at the end of the prologue, you know, there's the whole prologue, and then there's a fight on stage between the Jets and the Sharks, and he comes in and he pulls them apart. He and Krupke pull them apart, and he is just, as you said, he is so over it. He is so furious. He hates this, that he has to do this, two or three times a week.
The day.
And it made all the difference, because if he's just annoyed, like in the movie, as you said, it doesn't seem like the stakes are as high. So absolutely, you were completely right, and I couldn't believe how great he was.
So I did not RSVP to my invite to this, because I've been so overwhelmed with so much Tony Award stuff.
James, to be fair, I mean, all of us, you know, we're not looking forward to another West Side Story.
No, exactly.
I can understand why this would fall through the cracks for you. I mean, you know, nobody was excited when we saw the season announcement last year that it was going to end with West Side Story. Nobody was quarreling. Fine, do it. You know, no hard feelings.
I think a lot of theaters do a West Side Story to sell tickets and, you know, bolster their bottom line at the end of the season. So I kind of said, it's West Side Story, kind of put it on the back burner, didn't RSVP to it, but after 2 weeks of reviews from the two of you about this, I'm going to have to get out to Paper Mill in Millburn, New Jersey, and see it.
Well, I wouldn't have been looking forward to it if I thought it was just going to be another West Side Story, you know, because especially since I have seen so many great ones quite recently, as I mentioned. But had I known, I mean, I'm so glad I went. I would have been very sorry if I missed this. And honestly, really, I'm going to see if I can try to get the word out to people who might possibly, you know, whatever. But it would be so great if they can kind of get everybody together again sometime next year and do even a limited run at, I don't know, maybe at City Center or wherever.
And isn't it wonderful that this should happen when they're winning the Tony Award as Best Regional Theater?
Yes.
I mean, it would be really lousy if indeed they had a second-rate production out there now and winning the award, and people go out there and say, I don't see why this theater is so great. Now they'll go out there and see why this theater is so great.
And I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think, you know, they have been doing a lot of, they've been doing some shared productions, and they've also been doing some co-productions, and they've been doing some pre-Broadway productions that are financed by other people, but I think this is just a Paper Mill production.
I agree.
So all the more reason to applaud them for it.
Yeah, they have that the American premiere of The Bodyguard coming up in January or so. So it'd be fun to see the Paper Mill flexing its muscle that is so invigorating to Broadway in these in the last couple of years, a number of productions have, Paper Mill has changed the Broadway landscape, you know, Newsies and Honeymoon in Vegas and a few other things that have happened. That's great to see. Peter got a chance to get over to the Signature to see 3 one-act plays, which are written by, you know, little-known artists. Right, Peter?
Yes. Well, what's really wonderful is that if you missed the off-Broadway movement in the 60s, when it was a commercial enterprise, when people actually put on plays not in a not-for-profit arena, but actually put them on at these little theaters that used to dot the Lower East Side, the Village, they're almost all gone now. And but at the time, in the 60s, people actually put on plays hoping to make a buck. And looking at them now, it seems very strange that people would put such plays on to make a buck. The first one is Edward Albee's Sandbox, which was on a bill with other plays. And it is a very strange play, but it doesn't begin to be as strange as the two that follow, Drowning by Maria Irina Fornes and Funny House of a Negro by Adrian Kennedy. Those were not at the same time as The Sandbox. They came a little later. But this is a very remarkable way of looking at what off-Broadway used to be, when people used to produce hoping that people would come and see these offbeat plays. Now, there was a pause at the end of The Sandbox for literally 9 minutes. Now, how do I know it was 9 minutes? Did I look at my watch? No, there's actually a projection on the wall saying there will be a 9-minute pause. So you do know that you have 9 minutes to do whatever you have to do. What happened during much of that 9 minutes was I was overhearing people saying, "What was that?" But not nearly as much as the actual intermission that followed after Maria Irina Fornes's play, Drowning. People were really saying, "What was that?" So there's a lot of "what was that" here. No question about that. This is a situation where these plays are very, very offbeat. And what you are learning is that there was a time when off-Broadway meant great experimentation, great avant-garde. Now, if you saw an episode of The Dick Van Dyke Show where Laura is given a ticket to an off-Broadway play. Buddy, the comedy writer, who was played by Maury Amsterdam, a real old-world gag guy, he says, "Avant-garde." That means off-Broadway garbage. And a lot of people will think that these shows are. But if you look deeply into them, there are definite things that need to be said and are being said in a very unconventional way. So this is only a show for adventurous theater goers who can say, "Oh, I see what they're getting at. We're not being spoon-fed. We are being given metaphors." There's a lot of that going on. You're going to be very shocked when the lights come up after that 9-minute pause, because the two people on stage, and I use the term loosely on people, will shock you in the way that they look. And the whole point of the play is that, when you don't look so good, it's going to be hard to find somebody who's going to love you, and it's going to be very easy to find somebody who's going to hurt you. The third play, Funny House of a Negro, takes a lot of twists and turns in reminding us how difficult it's been to be black in this country. You might say, "We know that." Well, the fact is, this is done through a very different prism, and as a result, you're going to see, you're going to come to conclusions that you've come to before, but in very different ways. So I know that I'm making it sound adventurous. I want to. I know that I'm making it sound inscrutable. I want to. A lot of it is. But if you're up for a real theatrical adventure, yes, this is the place to go. I will certainly defend anybody's right to say, "What was that?" But nevertheless, what it really comes down to is that these people are artists who look at things in a very different way, and we're trying different things. Walter Kerr, in one of his books, once said, "You know, I go to all these plays and I see that playwrights know how to do things in the conventional way. They know how to do that important phone call. They know exactly when the first act curtain should come down. But I wonder if there's any other way of doing these things." Well, a lot of people rallied to that cry. And this is what happened with Edward Albee and Maria Irina Fornes and Adrian Kennedy. They were trying different forms. Did they succeed? We'll let you be the judge of that.
All right. So that is in its last 2 weeks at Signature. So if this is interesting, you should get down there and see it right now so that while everybody's focused on that Hamilton thing, you can get down and see the other gems. Next up in our little discussion is that Michael got over to the Appel Room to see Michael Feinstein and company. So first question for you, Michael, is why isn't Michael Feinstein at Feinstein's 54 Below?
Because he is very peripatetic, if we could use that word.
I love and that word.
I love that word.
How many people looked that up specifically because it's in Chorus Line? I know I do.
Yeah.
And although I think that they explained it at the time to whoever was Ed Kleban or maybe somebody else. Oh, by the way, peripatetic means this. You know. Anyway, he performs all over. He performs at Carnegie Hall. He performs at Carnegie Recital Hall, whatever that's called now. And yes, this is Jazz at Lincoln Center. The title of the program was Michael Feinstein, Sing Me a Swing Song, which, as he noted, if you try to say it fast, you're probably going to screw it up. So I tried to slow that down. This was with a 17-piece big band in the Appel Room, the fabulous Appel Room, formerly the Allen Room, overlooking Central Park. Ted Firth leading the band and playing piano. And Michael's guests were Alison Briggs, whom I had never heard of before, Jeremy Jordan, whom I have heard of before, and Catherine Russell, who's a really great jazz vocalist. And they all were fantastic. Alison Briggs, she's new to me, but I guess she is a real she really trades in nostalgia. She has a wonderful, beautiful period look, blonde hair, looks very, very 40s. Vocal resemblance to, I would say, Dinah Shore a lot, maybe some other singers of that era, Joe Stafford, a little Peggy Lee. And she was really great. Catherine Russell, I've heard once or twice before, and she's acknowledged as one of the great jazz and swing singers. And Jeremy Jordan is, I'm sure, familiar to many of our listeners from his theater work and also from Supergirl on TV. So let's see. There were a lot of swing songs in phenomenal arrangements, most of them by Ted Firth. I've Got the World on a String, That Old Black Magic, and then there were ballads too. Cry Me a River, which Jeremy Jordan sang and said that it was introduced. It was written for Ella Fitzgerald, and actually, Kevin McInerney, our friend, was there too, and we looked at each other and like, is that right? It sounded wrong, but Kevin looked it up, and apparently it was written for Ella Fitzgerald, but she didn't record it originally because Mitch Miller, who was the A&R head at, I guess, whatever label it was, I don't know, maybe Verve, said he didn't like the song because he didn't like the use of the word plebeian. So she didn't record it. And the first hit recording was by Julie London, which turned out to be a huge hit. And then later Barbara Streisand recorded it and many, many other people. But let's see. Lots of great songs and amazing arrangements, as I said. And three show tunes I counted. One is, I guess, qualifies as a show tune. Cole Porter's From This Moment On.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Was written for a show, but then cut and then... didn't they try to put it into a few other things, and then it was...
Yeah, it was originally in Out of This World, the show that followed Kiss Me, Kate. But then it showed up in the Kiss Me, Kate movie and the revival as well. So, but it's really interesting that when you think of it, that here was a song that was getting airplay when Out of This World was trying out, and George Abbott still said, well, I'm sorry, it just doesn't work. We have to take it out. It doesn't help the show. I would have loved to have seen Out of This World, period. period. I mean, I have seen it since in productions here and there, but I would have loved to have seen that Philadelphia tryout. I think it was Philadelphia, and see if, where it worked and what, were they right? Were they wrong? You know, I'd be very interested, but that's another time machine hope, but nothing more than that. But anyway, that's the history of From This Moment On.
And the irony is, to me, it's one of the absolute highlights of the film of Kiss Me, Kate. Unfortunately, when they put it back in the show for the, you know, the Brian Stokes Mitchell Maren Maisie revival, they did so in the completely wrong way, which I've never understood. But anyway, and then the other two show tunes were I Gotta Be Me from Golden Rainbow. Which Michael sang, and Michael and Jeremy did a rejiggered version of You're Nothing Without Me from City of Angels that originally had been prepared for Michael to do with Cheyenne Jackson at the old Feinsteins at the Regency. And in fact, they recorded that that version because they recorded that whole concert, so you can get a hold of that. I believe the new lyrics are by Michael in consultation with David Zippel, who wrote the original. But I have to double check that. It's rewritten, so it's not about a detective, not about a writer secret, but about two performers saying. And actually, it's really sweet because it's changed from "You're nothing without me" to "I'm nothing without you." Have you heard this version, Peter?
No,
it's worth hearing. It's really fun.
Sure.
So it was a great night. The friend that I brought, Kevin was there, but he was not with me. The friend that I brought had never heard a big band play live before.
Oh,
and
isn't that
so.
Something?
Yeah, and it was amazing. In fact, if anything, it was at moments it was a little too much because the Appel room has a lot of glass and a lot of wood, and sometimes it was almost too live, but just occasionally, and it was still thrilling and just a privilege to be there.
All right, so that is really another way for us to see amazing talent here in New York. It's not just all on Broadway, which we keep focusing on. That's really great.
Well, then actually, if I could force this segue, I also saw this week Sin Twisters, which is the fabulous show that Penny Fuller and Anita Gillette have been doing at the Metropolitan Room, and I'm happy to tell you that they are scheduled to do it again not till September 25th for some reason. I guess they have stuff going on over the summer, but they are going to be back at the Metropolitan Room on September 25th at 7 p.m. The cover charge is $29. I think that's a pretty great, and I believe there's a 2-drink minimum, but the drinks aren't especially expensive. To say that it's worth it is an incredible understatement. Their show is amazing. They have been friends for decades. They have performed together before, and of course separately on many, many occasions. This program is put together by Barry Kleinbord. Has so much great stuff in it, including two of the most beautiful show tunes ever written. Magic Moment from
The Gay Life.
And Once Upon a Time from All American. But as Lee Adams, the author of the lyrics, told us when I asked him on the podcast several months ago, that was actually a trunk song that he and Charles Strauss had written. I forget what he said it was for now. It may have been a TV show or a Broadway show. Regardless, it's such a beautiful song. And I, after the show at the Metropolitan Room, I said to Anita and Penny, I said, "You may not know this, but blah, blah, blah. It's a trunk song." And it was so funny because Anita said, "What's a trunk song?" Penny turned to her and said, "Oh, Anita, that's when, blah, 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 when a song is written for something and it's thrown in the trunk and then it's hauled out years later and put into something else." And she goes, "Oh, I never heard that. I didn't know that. That's so interesting to know."
For the record, they did a Strauss and Adams, when they were starting out, did a show on Long Island called What's the Rush? And Once Upon a Time came from that.
Oh, okay. I think that is what. Were you with us when Lee Adams was on? It's Peter.
Yeah, yeah, but I don't think I don't agree with that specific at that point. But anyway, what's the rush? I mean, I even have a playbill from it. So, and of course, it could be effectively argued that just because a playbill says "Once Upon a Time," it doesn't mean it's necessarily that song. It wouldn't hold up in court, but I suspect it is.
Well, you know, because I asked him point blank, I've always thought that it's such a beautiful song, but it doesn't really seem to fit the character in that show. And so, yes, he said it was a trunk song. And, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that because now we have a beautiful song in a Broadway show. The rest of the program, just quickly, the Met Room was great. They sang songs like "You're the Top" and "We Got Us" from Golden Rainbow. I heard two songs from Golden Rainbow in two different cabaret shows this week. So how many other people can say that? And then the finale was really amazing because Penny Fuller was apparently the understudy in the original production of Cabaret, and said that she went on for Jill Haworth 100 times. And then Anita was the replacement, or a replacement, Sally Bowles. So she obviously went on a lot. And so both ladies played the role back then, and they did a wonderful medley from the show, including they both did amazing Lotta Lenya impersonations. And the icing on the cake was that the night I went, Joel Grey was in the audience.
Oh, how wonderful.
So it was just amazing. So Sunday, September 25th, 7 p.m., Metropolitan Room, $29 cover, Anita Gillette and Penny Fuller. Mark it on your calendar.
I recall that Anita also said that she was Barbara Cook's understudy in The Gay Life in Detroit. But then Anita was written out of the show and, in fact, then came to New York and got All American. But the way that Anita sang Magic Moment, she proved that had she continued with the show and if Barbara Cook had fallen ill, the audience wouldn't have been remotely cheated.
I think what she said the other night, Peter, is that she did remain with the show as the understudy, but her part had been cut down. Originally, she opened the show standing on a bridge and singing something Anatole, oh Anatole, and then they came to her and said, "Sorry, Anita, we have to cut that song." And whoever she said, I didn't look it up, whoever the costume designer was said, "You can't cut that song. It's the best costume in the show." but they did.
All right. So let's move forward into our next review. Before we started the show, we were talking about what we were going to talk about. We talk about that before the show, every show. And Peter mentioned that he had seen Taming of the Shrew in Central Park. And I was concerned that maybe we weren't allowed to talk about it yet, but I looked it up and we are allowed to talk about it. So, Peter, why don't you tell us what you thought about the Central Park Public Theater production of Taming of the Shrew?
Well, I will say this, that it's an all-female production, but if you don't know that going in, I have a feeling that Janet McTeer as Petruchio and Judy Gold as Grameo and maybe even Donna Lynn Champlin as Hortensio would fool you. Certainly Janet McTeer, who's so butch as Petruchio and really looks the part, and really, Judy Gold surprised me as well. I mean, it really is tremendous in that way. It's a very cut-down version. Anybody looking for Christopher Sly will not find him here. And it runs a little less than 2 hours. There's no intermission whatsoever. So do prepare by going to that little house next to the theater beforehand, because you'll need to. And a rollicking production. Philippa Lloyd did the direction, and it's set in a circus atmosphere. And it is a rollicking circus, no question about that. So, all things considered, this is a top-notch revival of Taming of the Shrew, and it's done very stylistically because, after all, this is a tough play for us to take now. We don't want any woman tamed, especially given the fact that she doesn't seem to be so unreasonable in her demands by contemporary standards. Not at all. We don't think that she's a shrew. I mean, she just wants what she feels she deserves, and she does deserve. So doing it in a very stylistic way really helps amazingly, because this is certainly a play that has seen its day. And I'm surprised it gets done as much as it does. But if it's going to get done, it should be done in this really funky, strange, in the best sense of the word, way. So I think you'll have a wonderful time out there, especially if the weather's good. So I do say get over there. You'll have to make a day of it to get tickets, of course. They don't make it easy for you. They made it easier, of course, with various ways of getting tickets. But still, most of the people just go there and have a nice picnic before they get their tickets. But a lot of laughter, a lot of fun, and I do recommend it heartily.
Awesome. I'm going to go see that in a couple of weeks, right before it officially closes. And so I'll report back on that. Michael, you got a chance to get over to Manhattan Theater Club to see Incognito. So it's at City Center, actually, but it's a Manhattan Theater Club production. So tell us about that.
Well, this is a new play by Nick Payne, who wrote Constellations, which got a lot of attention in its Broadway production because of the participation of Jake Gyllenhaal. But it really was a very good play aside from that, and I really enjoyed it. So I was looking forward to this. Like that one, it requires a lot of attention, but even more so in this case, because I would say, to me, the negative aspect of it is that you have, as the ads and the marketing say, three stories, 21 characters, four actors. To me, maybe it's partly my limited brain capacity, but I have a limit as to how much of actors switching roles I can take before I start to become confused. And it's a tribute to these four actors, Geneva Carr, Charlie Cox, Heather Lind, and Morgan Spector, how often I was not confused and how clear it was for the most part. And also, obviously, a tribute to the playwright and also to director Doug Hughes. But there were many places where I was not quite sure. You know, it takes a while to adjust from one story to another, one set of characters to another. In this case, it was made somewhat easier in that they had different accents. But still, you don't immediately get what's going on, and sometimes it takes a while. And if you're trying to figure out what's happening, then you're missing what they're saying. at least that's what happened to me to a certain extent. I don't want to overstate it, but I still enjoyed it. It's about, the three stories are: a pathologist steals the brain of Albert Einstein, a neuropsychologist embarks on her first romance with another woman, and a seizure patient forgets everything but how much he loves his girlfriend. Charlie Cox played the seizure patient, and he did a really wonderful job in that. There was something that happened in the play that I sort of predicted from the beginning, and sure enough, it turned out to be the last thing that happens in the play, but I won't say anything more than that. It's very interesting about the nature of memory and the way the mind works, and definitely worth seeing. I would say one of the best shows I've seen at Manhattan Theater Club in recent memory. They have not been doing that well recently, as we have, I think, pointed out in the past. But this is a really, really worthy piece of work by Nick Payne, who I think has a really great career ahead of him.
All right. So another good one. We had talked about Manhattan Theater Club a few times about the disappointment in recent shows, and so hopefully this is the beginning of a turnaround for them, where we're going to be more excited to see stuff. Peter got a chance to get over to Rattlesnake's Playwrights Theater and to see Cal in Camo. So Peter, tell us about Cal in Camo.
Well, this is one of those plays that ends with a blackout, and you expect people to come out and join hands and take bows, because 80 minutes have passed. Lord knows we have plenty of 80-minute plays now, but the thing is, it seems so incomplete. It deals with a very unhappy marriage, and Cal is the wife. That's where that comes from. I have no idea what the rest of the title means, but a very unhappy marriage. The husband's a salesman. He's not doing that well. The first scene, in fact, we see him trying to sell one of his products to somebody who just is not responsive at all. But he comes home, and he's a new father. She's a new mother, of course. And the point is that he really wanted this child, and she did not at all. And she has not bonded with this child for a tenth of a second. This is a very different take, God knows, on motherhood, because most people who see their baby for the first time, it's love at first sight, really, legitimately love at first sight. So, but that hasn't happened to her. And part of the thing that's complicating the matter is that she's not doing very well with breastfeeding, to the point at which she even opens up her shirt and shows us her breasts, which are terribly, terribly bruised. It's really disconcerting to see breasts look in this condition. It's hardly erotic for those people who like to see bare breasts. This is not the show to see bare breasts under those circumstances. So anyway, her brother's coming to visit because her brother's had a terrible experience. His wife drowned, and the brother is a real ne'er-do-well, a real slacker. And, of course, the husband doesn't want him to come. So under all these circumstances, you see so much unpleasantness. Yes, that last moment before it happens, the blackout happens, there is a nice moment. And, yes, it is true that the brother, who seems to be doing nobody any good at all, does do some good. But still, it's the type of play where I'd like to see a second act. Even though, I'll give it away to some degree, the mother is going to make more of an effort to love her child. I'd like to see what happens after she makes that first effort. Will she make a second one? Will she make a third? Has her life really changed? Will she now be a good mother? I'm not sure, and I'd like to see if that were the case. So, so a very incomplete play, and for that matter, for the most part, an unpleasant play, and some people want to stay away from those because life's hard enough, and what they go through every day is certainly harrowing enough that they don't need to see it when they go to the theater. Other people, of course, have different values about that and like to see harrowing plays. If so, this is the one for you.
Well, I believe camo is a short for camouflage, isn't it?
I've never heard that. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how that would apply to, you know, to her in terms of what you just said.
Yeah, I haven't seen this show, but I was wondering if he was former military, because camo implies that's what military folks call their camouflage uniform is camo.
Yeah. But I was around for the draft way back when, but my lottery number was 360. Which means that 359 days worth of people would have to be drafted before me. It's the only lottery I've ever won, you know. So, but I was very glad to win it during that period of time. So I know beans about the military, I have to admit.
All right. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we are recording in the morning of the Tony Awards before the actual awards are given out. So if you're listening to this afterwards, you might have more information than we do. But I thought
we should probably just keep our mouths shut, but we're not going to.
We are not known for keeping our mouths shut, are we? So what we're going to do is wrap up in the previous number of weeks we covered all different categories: leading actor and actress in a play and a musical, featured actor and actress in a play and a musical. We did the best play, best musical type of things a number of weeks ago. Also, Matt Temenini, my partner in crime, has put together a 2.5-hour podcast where he and I interviewed all the other major podcasts out there and we did a Tony Awards roundup. We call that the Tony Awards Omnibus wrap-up. That is available in iTunes and other ways that you get the Broadway Radio podcasts. So we have that there. But Peter and Michael and I have not talked about a few categories. So let's start with Best Book of a Musical, where we had Bright Star, Hamilton, School of Rock, and Shuffle Along. So Peter, what do we think about Best Book?
I'm surprised we're even discussing this. These are foregone conclusions, best book and best score. Do you need me to say the word that begins with the H, that ends with the N?
maybe only if you disagree with anything. We want to make sure that we don't make assumptions.
Fine. I do not disagree. I do think that Hamilton is the best book of the season.
All right, Michael?
Same here.
All right.
Sorry not to be more.
more much to say.
Well, no, for the sake of completeness, we didn't want to get together next week and have either one of you say, yeah, we never talked about this, and I was thinking all along that School of Rock was going to take it all. So, if that were to happen. So we just did score and best book for Hamilton, and all three of us are in agreement there. In the other categories that we haven't talked about yet, best direction of a play, we have Rupert Gold for King Charles III, Jonathan Kent for Long Day's Journey and Tonight, Joe Mantello for The Humans, Liesl Tommy for Eclipsed, and Ivo Van Hove for A View from the Bridge. Arthur Miller's A View from the Bridge, as I've been scolded. Peter, what do you think about that?
Well, the question becomes, will it go to a revival or a new play? Because certainly the big contenders are A View from the Bridge, which is where my vote would go. But The Humans has picked up so much traction as time has gone on. It's a play that has really gained and esteemed in its Broadway run. So, and Scott Rudin does have a lot of friends. So it's not impossible that Joe Mantello is going to win. But I do feel it really should go to A View from the Bridge, because while The Humans is very well directed, it is a conventional staging, and I don't mean that as a knock. I mean that this is the way the play has to be staged. It's a very naturalistic, realistic play, and under those circumstances, you give that type of direction to it. But Ivo Van Hove really had to reimagine what he was doing, and he reimagined it sensationally. So under those circumstances, I hope it's going to be A View from the Bridge.
Michael, what do you think?
Well, I disagree, because he didn't have to reimagine. He chose to reimagine. And although I think he did a much better job of reimagining in A View from the Bridge than he did in The Crucible, I still think there was that much was lost, specifically in terms of the terrible miscasting of the two brothers, from Italy. I think that they were so wrong for those roles that it kind of really wrecked the story. But also partly the way they were directed. So there was much I liked about it, but much I did not. And also, I almost feel I can't really judge that show, because I had an amazing seat on the stage. And I imagine that the experience was not necessarily as rewarding for those who were in the house. So that's why I'm not really sure about that. I think that for me, I guess maybe I would say Jonathan Kent, because this is really the most the least problematic production of Long Day's Journey that I have ever seen, in terms of pacing and just avoidance of unwanted laughter at the more heightened moments that occur, and the interaction between the actors and the casting, which is really quite wonderful. So I would probably vote for him, although Joe Mantello, I think, also did a superb job. And as for Eclipsed, as I mentioned before, I had an audibility problem with that show, so I can't really judge that one either.
Referring back to what Peter said before, The Humans seem to be gaining so much momentum. I think that Joe Mantello is going to win it.
And it, well, you know, it is nice if, since they don't separate the categories, which ideally, I guess maybe they would, although there are so many awards already. But since they don't separate the categories, I guess it's nice if a director of a new play wins. Hmm.
In the Best Direction of a Musical, we have Michael Arden for Spring Awakening, John Doyle for The Color Purple, Scott Ellis for She Loves Me, Thomas Kail for Hamilton, and George C. Wolfe for Shuffle Along. Is this a foregone conclusion as well, Peter?
Sure, as well it should be. As somebody who has seen probably 80% of the musicals that have been produced on Broadway in the last half century, I would definitely rank This Direction as among the 10 best I have ever seen. So even if Bartlett Shea were nominated in this category, and I think he should have been for Fiddler on the Roof, and at the Drama Desk Awards last week when he did win Best Direction, outright for a few minutes and then not outright. I don't know if you know the story, but... the gentleman who was opening the envelope saw Bartlett Shea's name and said that he won the Drama Desk Award, and that was that. But a few minutes later, host Michael Urey came out and said, actually, it was a tie. John Doyle won, too. I don't know if it was a case that he didn't notice there were two cards in there. I don't know if he just pulled out the envelope enough to see Bartlett Shea and Fiddler on the Roof and didn't pull out one and see and John Doyle for The Color Purple. But anyway, whatever happened, I have to say the biggest whoop I gave that night was for Bartlett Shea, so I'm very sorry he wasn't nominated in this category, because that would have been my vote. But no, it wouldn't. Michael was just mentioning Best Direction being split into Revival and New Show. If that were happening, I would be much happier, because I cannot deny Thomas Kail what he achieved here. And I'm very happy it's going to go to him, because I have seen very few shows that have better direction.
Michael, what did you think?
I think all of the nominees are eminently deserving, except I guess I would make an exception for Scott Ellis, because I did think that the tone of She Loves Me is not really right. And also I mentioned several times that it doesn't seem to have any period flavor about it.
I agree
very entirely. Enjoyable, but mm-hmm. I think those are two pretty great liabilities. Right. I don't think this is Bartlett Shea's best work by any stretch of the imagination. So I'm not sorry that he's not included. I think he has done and will do much, much better things, including how many times can I say this? The unbelievably beautiful production of The King and I, which we now hear is closing on the 26th of this month. It is better than it has ever been with Maren Mazie and Daniel Day Kim. So get thee to that if you can. Just a little interesting point. Peter took part, and I was in the audience, in a discussion at the Drama Bookshop the other day, relative to, Matt Winman's new book, What the Critics Say, because Peter's one of the critics interviewed in it. And also on the panel were Roma Torre, Jesse Green, Zack Snyder, and who am I leaving out?
Well, Matt.
Oh, yeah, right. I guess that's it.
That was it, yeah.
Yeah. But the interesting thing about that, aside from all the interesting things that were said, is that it took place in the basement space, sort of theater-like space, I guess, of the Drama Bookshop, which was the birthplace of In the Heights. And, of course, it was the same team for Hamilton, including Thomas Kail and Lin-Manuel Miranda et al. So I almost brought that up when I made a statement and asked a question, because Hamilton was mentioned several times at this discussion at the Drama Bookshop. You know, it came up for various reasons, and I wanted to say I wasn't sure if everyone there realized that where we were sitting was essentially the birthplace of. I'm not sure if they actually worked on Hamilton in that space, but I know they worked on In the Heights there. And of course, if there probably wouldn't have been a Hamilton if there wasn't In the Heights. So in a sense, it was the birthplace of that that whole creative team. And in fact, I forget if we discussed this, there was a flood at the Drama Bookshop several months ago, and they were really in trouble because, you know, they don't have a huge profit margin, and they said that the insurance would pay for it, but they didn't know how long it would take for that to happen. And so Lin-Manuel Miranda led a fundraising effort to help them out, and because he, you know, he realized that if it wasn't for them, who knows where he would be right now. And I think that's great, and I think Tommy Cale is very deserving, and I would be very, very happy if he wins.
So I think that Hamilton will win, but I think that George C. Wolfe did an amazing job on Shuffle Along, and I think that that's a horse race. We'll have to see what happens tonight. In the Best Choreography category, we have Andy Blankenbuehler for Hamilton, Savon Glover for Shuffle Along, Hofesh Schechter on Fiddler on the Roof, Randy Skinner, Dames at Sea, and Sergio Trullo for On Your Feet. So, Michael, what did you think of this category?
Trujillo, by the way.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, but that's okay. I think this is one of those sort of apples and oranges categories in that the style of the choreography in all of those shows is so vastly different, and everyone did such an amazing job at the style that the style or styles that they used in each one that I'm not even going to attempt to make my own choice. I guess I would say that I don't know. Andy Blankenbuehler may well win, partly because of the Hamilton juggernaut, but also because he deserves it. On the other hand, I don't know. I mean, I could give reasons why each one of them might win. So I think I should probably just stop.
All right, Peter.
I think it's going to be Savion Glover. I recall being in the press room, I probably said this before, the night that the producers was doing so well, and the journalists really gave out a grunt of astonishment when Mel Brooks won for best score. They really thought it was going to go the full Monty. So it is possible, as Michael uses the word juggernaut, that Hamilton will make it happen. But this is indeed the newest kid on the block, Shuffle Along, certainly not Savion Glover. And because it's more fresh in our minds, I think it may very well be the show that gets the attention here. I'm not sure how much Shuffle Along is going to win, but I think this is its best shot, and I think it will happen.
And also, as I said previously, Savion Glover has been famous as a dancer and choreographer on Broadway for quite some years now, despite the fact that he's still quite young. But as far as I know, everything he did previously was a very, very, very different style of dancing.
Sure.
And a new age style of tap that is, you know, a descendant of, but very, very, very different from the classic type of tap and other types of dance forms that we see in Shuffle Along. So I was so impressed by that that I would not be remotely sorry if he wins.
All right. Next in the category, Best Orchestration. August Eriksmonen. What, Michael? Pronunciation? Eriksmonen?
Eriksmonen.
Eriksmonen?
M-O-E-N. Eriksmonen, I think.
For Bright Star, Larry Hotchman for She Loves Me, Alex Lacamoire for Hamilton, and Daryl Waters for Shuffle Along. So, Michael, what did you think of this?
You know, to be honest, I hadn't given it much thought, but it might go to Daryl Waters because of, again, you know, to recreate the sound of these very old well, you know, to sort of, I guess, attempt to recreate what these songs must have sounded like when they were done in the 20s, but in a way that appeals to modern audiences as well, and then also, you know, orchestrating the new material. I think that's a really great achievement. The Shalozzi orchestrations, I still haven't made a decision. I just got the album recently, and I've been listening to them again. I think that they're good. I think they're maybe a little too busy in places compared to the original orchestration. So as far as I'm concerned, the jury is still out on that. And in Hamilton, Alex Lacamoire is a really great artist. I didn't feel like the focus was on the orchestrations as much for, I guess, obvious reasons. And Bright Star, everything was fine. I didn't really focus on that. Although having the band on stage for much of it or some of it, I guess that maybe helped to place some emphasis on the orchestrations.
Peter, what did you think?
Well, Larry Hawkman won the other night the Drama Desk Awards for She Loves Me, but of course he wasn't going up against Hamilton, which was all last year for the Drama Desk, which acknowledges Off-Broadway as well. So I think this is one that will go to Hamilton as well, because it's a sound we haven't heard before.
Interesting.
All right, so we will know what we know later on tonight. Before we wrap up for today, Jennifer Ashley Tepper, who we've discussed numerous times here, wrote this great post this morning on Facebook that I wanted to share with everybody quickly. 10 things that happened this Broadway season that people would have said, this could never happen if they happened on Smash. The first one is, the season's big musical takes over the world. It's hailed as the greatest piece of theater of all time. The president of the United States becomes BFF with the creator. There is an article in the New York Times every day, and celebrities in the sold-out audience every night. Tickets cost $12,000. It racks up in advance of $100 million. All of those things happened.
No, she's right, isn't she? We wouldn't have believed this on Smash, would we? Very good point. Yeah, good for her. Good for her.
Next one is, a mega movie star uses B12 shots, teleprompters, an earpiece, and cursing tantrums to get through a disastrous play that audience storm out in droves demanding refunds.
Now, when I did the Theater World Awards emceeing, I was toying with the idea of saying that Al Pacino really gave it his all, and it was really amazing to see a man who's getting close to being an octogenarian working so hard. I went twice to make this play work, and nobody could accuse him of phoning it in. However, of course, they were phoning it into him. I didn't use it. Yeah, I didn't use the joke because I didn't think it was strong enough. But I went twice, as I say, and you're saying, well, that's very strange, because after all, it was a play that was considered to be a disaster. But to watch this man really take on this challenge of taking on a play where he had 99.44% of the play that he had to do was really something, and I admired that. So it's another reason I didn't make the joke, because I think he needed more respects than jokes for what he at least attempted to do this season.
All right, the third thing on Jennifer's list is that the Broadway play offers investors a chance to have their dog featured in a montage at the stage curtain in exchange for $50,000. That's funny, Sylvia. Number four, former married couples each star in one of Broadway's biggest nonprofit companies' two spring musicals, exiting your stage door every night to sign autographs in front of giant posters of your former spouse. That's so unrealistic, they'd say, if it happened on Smash. Of course, it's She Loves Me and Robert Bridegroom. Five, random police officer who has never written a musical creates a show about a heroic slave trader that, against all odds, makes it to Broadway, which is Amazing Grace. Number six, beloved mainstream singer-songwriter leads all-female team to the finish line while insisting the entire theater smell like pies. Mainstream music legend and icon writes first stage show and then dies, making his last public appearance at opening night. Movie star and comedy legend makes surprise appearances on stage during intermission of his show playing the banjo. Number
I've seen this happen, by the way. I was there one of those performances, and it was just very nice how low-key he was about... we're talking about Steve Martin, by the way, in Bright Star. And it's just very nice how he was so genial in the way he looked and came in, just did his little thing and went off. But the audience really felt it was an extra special treat, understandably so.
And mainstream music legend was David Bowie down at New York Theatre Workshop with his show. Number seven, star dramatically and prematurely exit show, bewailing publicity that she was only used for her box office draw, not her talent. Seriously. Jennifer comments, seriously, you can just hear the smash-hating watchers going, that would never happen.
Although, for what it's worth, I believe that she was only announced until that date. I don't think, I think from the beginning that she was only announced till that date. So in that sense, it wasn't premature.
Yeah. Number eight, late 20s hardworking actor who has mainly played sidekicks and understudies appears in the ensemble of a reading, is suddenly promoted by Broadway's wealthiest writer to leading role and becomes the breakout star of the season. Sardi caricatures and all. That's very funny.
Alex Brightman,
yeah. Nine, show about to open on Broadway is canceled while in rehearsals with sets and costumes already in the theater.
All the money
is lost and actors perform their Broadway show one time in a rehearsal room for 30 people. Which was nerds.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, when at the Theater World Awards, I was making a joke about the fact that Lin-Manuel Miranda may come here tonight if he can get off his day job at Costco. I said he thinks he can get somebody to come in for him, the producer of Nerds. He needs the money. And I have to say that the audience groaned with sympathy, and that's rather nice, that they really felt bad for Nerds as opposed to scoffing at it. I mean, I came off as insensitive as opposed to funny, and I have to say guilty as charged. But it also showed me what a nice theater-going crowd comes to the Theater World Awards. So yes, indeed, who would have believed that near yesterday? The only time I can really think of this happening, by the way, and of course there may have been millions of other examples, but what comes to mind is a show in 1966 called Little World Hello, and Baby Boomers may recall an entertainer, a child's entertainer when we were little kids, named Pinky Lee. Very much in the Pee Wee Herman mold. Pee Wee Herman definitely borrowed a lot from Pinky Lee, and there was going to be a musical called Little World Hello, which was set in a castle based on a novel by Jimmy Savo, who was also involved with the Boys from Syracuse way back when. And they got into rehearsal, and then they couldn't finish either. And it was supposed to come to Boston, where I was living at the time, and play its pre-Broadway tryout at the Schubert. And while it would have been fun to see it, when they canceled, Mame said, oh, we'll take the booking. And so as a result, we got to see Mame before it went to Broadway, which was very exciting.
Wow, that's great. So I don't know how, I don't know when, I don't know where this will happen, but I somehow imagine sometime in my lifetime that late on a Sunday evening, Jennifer Ashley Tepper is going to take a stage and accept a Tony Award. Uh-huh. And I can't wait for that speech.
Did you complete the list? Did you read number 10?
Oh, 10, so 10, only 10, one. Yeah, 10 was the throwaway. 10 was, she wrote, whatever is about to happen tomorrow. So so she left it open for a sequel, perchance.
There was only one I didn't get. What was the one about four married couples or something?
Former married couples. It's Laura Benanti and Stephen Pasquale.
She
Loves Me and that Rubber Bridegroom. Worth working
could I
for.
Hear the one, could I hear the one again about the person who left the show? Because I had a different take on that.
Person who left the show. It's Color Purple. It's Cynthia Erivo. Jennifer Hudson.
Could I hear it again?
Star dramatically and prematurely exit show, bewailing publicly that she was only used for her box office draw, not for her talent. And yeah, she had tweeted that after the Tony Award nominations, that she said she was only used for her box office, not her talent.
But that was the one where I said that I think she was only scheduled.
Yeah.
Until that point. So in that sense, she didn't leave prematurely, although she did leave prematurely in the sense that she wasn't in it very long.
Yeah. And while we have been recording this, the Tony Awards have posted something on Twitter that they're dedicating the night to the victims in the Orlando shooting that happened tragically early this morning. And the Tony Award production said, "Our hearts are heavy for the unimaginable tragedy that happened last night in Orlando. Our thoughts are with families and friends of those affected. The Tony Awards dedicate tonight's ceremony to them." So I guess that wraps it up for us today, with the exception of the trivia, which will come in just a moment. So if you go to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, there'll be a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your Android device. Get us streamed to you directly. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com. So, Peter, tell us about last week's trivia answer.
Well, I asked what show had two Tony winners in it that ran the shortest length of time. And Robert Lobiondo said, well, that's got to be Dance a Little Closer, because Len Cariou and George Rose were billed above the title. But I don't consider George Rose a lead in Dance a Little Closer. I see him as a supporting person. Mm. And this seems to get back to the type of thing that the Tonys used to do about where you were billed was important on what category you'd be in. So so that wasn't the answer I was looking for, but I won't say he was wrong. But Jake Leonard was the one who got it. What I was looking for was Ken Howard and Patricia Routledge in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He won for Child's Play, and she won for Darling of the Day, and they were both in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, which ran seven performances. So that's the answer to that one, and congratulations to Jake Leonard for guessing what was on my mind. I guess that's the best way we can put it. This week, two writers with the exact same three initials had a marked influence on a world-famous and pretty much esteemed Broadway musical. One had his influence before the show was created. The other had his influence after the original Broadway production had closed and long after it had been snubbed by the Tony Committee, which denied it a Best Musical nomination. So name the show as well as both writers. Again, the same three initials, and tell how they influenced the musical.
Boy, that's really interesting.
Yeah. All right. If you have a clue about this answer, please email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The chocolate drop. Everybody's drunk now. Go down the street by the school. Pat your feet, you stepping fool. Lose the alley, dodge the can. Shake Miss Sally's pots and pans. Clean your dogs, we're coming. Get set for easy. Quarter past. You're right. And you're right. Pilates.